Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the new regime taking charge in Washington, D.C., led by an insecure narcissist who paints a dark vision of life in America, then promises to fix the very problems he is exaggerating and in some cases inventing. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell, joins us to discuss a cabinet and an executive branch that appears to be the most disorganized, amateurish, and inexperienced in recent history, as well as Donald Trump's remark on Saturday at CIA headquarters, where he announced that he might redo the Iraq War, but this time get it right and take the country's oil. With a Democratic opposition adrift and Republicans in Congress more interested in power than principle, we will assess when and what opposition might emerge to stop an authoritarian takeover of America. Then we'll speak with Heidi Hartmann, the president of the Washington-based Institute for Women's Policy Research, whose areas of expertise are women and the economy, workforce participation, employment pay equity, and retirement security. We will discuss yesterday's historic march for women in the nation's capital, across the country and around the world, and analyze the extent to which yesterday's extraordinary manifestation of political energy can be coupled with a political strategy which appears to be lacking in terms of a Democratic opposition. Then we'll examine Donald Trump's petulant and infantile display on Saturday in front of the CIA's wall of fallen officers who died in anonymity in service to their country. A former 23-year veteran of the CIA's clandestine service who retired as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats, Glenn Carl, the author of The Interrogator and Education, joins us to discuss the new Trump administration's frantic efforts to shut down counterintelligence investigations into possible Trump campaign collusion with the Kremlin. Then finally, we'll discuss the extent to which the Democratic Party is adrift with much of its top officials in the DNC and among Hillary Clinton's operatives like David Brock in denial about their recent defeats, which they portray as a black swan event and blame on the FBI director and Putin. Democratic strategist Mike Lux, the president of American Family Voices and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies, joins us to look into the dogged refusal of the Democratic Party establishment to acknowledge the Bernie Sanders revolution and populist messages coming from the millennial generation, labor organizers, and grassroots activists. And joining us now is Lawrence Wilkerson, a retired United States Army colonel and former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. And currently he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And I mean, what's your assessment of my introduction there? Was I being hyperbolic in describing our new leader as an insecure narcissist who paints a dark vision of life in America, then promises to fix the very problems he's exaggerating and in some case inventing?
I don't think so. I think that's a pretty apt description. I would add that in the 12 years now in the civilian world and 6 years in the military world that I've been teaching presidential decision-making post-World War II, the one factor I think my some 500-plus students would agree to is that if you have inexperience, you have a problem, you have a danger that you don't have otherwise. Now, granted, we haven't had that many experienced presidents, Eisenhower, H.W. Bush, perhaps, break that mold, but we have had some experience in the advisory staff that they gathered around them, even George W. Bush. In this case, noting that inexperience is the most dangerous characteristic of any administration, this administration breaks the mold. There is no experience, period. And in addition to there being no experience, there is an intellectual temperament, a character, and so forth that simply doesn't fit the particular positions these people have been put into, whether it's Rex Tillerson at the State Department or Mike Flynn as National Security Advisor, two very important positions. This is going to be a frightening experience for our allies and friends, an opportunistic moment, perhaps, for some of our more virulent enemies, And it's going to be anxious at the least, and it's going to be traumatic at the most for Americans.
But the most disturbing remark, I thought, was on Saturday in front of the wall of the fallen CIA officers at CIA headquarters, where Donald Trump said that he might redo the Iraq war, but this time get it right and take the country's oil. I mean, that is a combination of recklessness and ignorance, which is, I think, breathtaking and unprecedented.
I don't disagree with that. It is a complete misinterpretation of U.S. policy, at least since 78, when President Carter declared that region a vital national interest. And you could argue all the way back to FDR when he met with the king of Saudi Arabia, but certainly since Carter, because in the modern age, it has not been U.S. policy to grab oil. That was always a misnomer or mistake in interpreting the Iraq war. It's to guarantee our access and our allies, and I put very heavy emphasis on our allies like Japan, who have no indigenous assets at all, is to guarantee access at a reasonable price, consistently, and without great problems in getting that access. That's what our policy has been. We don't want the oil for ourselves. We've got plenty of oil, especially now with the fracking and shale oil extraction and everything else. Mexico, Canada, they're our principal partners, Venezuela. We don't even get any oil for ourselves from that region of the world anymore. So, yeah, okay, if you want to be just purely greedy and say we'd like to have that oil and we'd like to have the resources it creates, that's one thing. But on the other hand, that's a violation of our policy, because our policy has been to ensure access to oil, not to grab it. And I would argue that the economics of grabbing it would be as dangerous as the economics of not ensuring access to it. So, as you said, it's a blatant display of ignorance of the world situation, security-wise, foreign policy-wise, and certainly with regard to oil.
But obviously, one cannot make sweeping psychiatric diagnoses, particularly with not having treated the patient. But on the surface, you can't help noticing that there's something delusional about Donald Trump. The way that he continues to exaggerate the size of his imaginary landslide victory, and now this flap that he's created over the size of the crowds at his inauguration, where they made pretty clear comparisons, visual comparisons, to Obama's 2009 inauguration, and then the following day, of course, you had this massive global and national manifestation of women spontaneously erupting. And as I say, this is political energy in search of a strategy. But it's certainly a pretty amazing manifestation, wouldn't you say? So
I would. You have to look at it and say, I've been to a number of inaugurations, so I know what I saw. Maybe 250,000 at the most. It certainly wasn't what Obama generated for either one of his inaugurations, in my view. But you also have to look at it from the perspective of the way this man deals with things. He's called Rove times 10. The truth is what I tell you it is. And my God, I'm not even going to be like Karl Rove and make sure the truth at least has some modicum of reality associated with it. I'm going to blow it up so big and so hyperbolically, so exaggeratedly, that it's going to stun you what I'm doing, but I'm going to tell you it's the truth. That seems to be a part of the way he operates. And his truths, even more disturbingly, are different day by day, week by week. One minute he's for this, the next minute he's against it, the next minute he's sort of in the middle. He's the last person, possibly the last person on the face of the earth that I would wish into the Oval Office.
I was struck in his inauguration, not in the specifics, but obviously there was a very dark vision. He was talking about he will stop the carnage, which is an extraordinary I mean, to my mind, the only carnage that happens in this country is these repeated massacres by assault rifles, which are readily available. And in fact, the one person in his cabinet that was asked in terms of confirmation hearings by the Senate asked about the guns in school, which you'd think in any civilized country there wouldn't even be an issue. All she could say was, well, we need guns in school in case a grizzly bear shows up. So it struck me as being, I don't know what's going on here. This is a, it feels to me like a demagogue saying, you have these terrible problems and I'm going to fix them. And the problems seem to be exaggerated, in some cases simply made up. And yet the agenda to fix them is simply me, trust me. Yeah, I alone can fix them. So doesn't that have sort of fatherland types of echoes?
It does. I'm looking at it from two perspectives now. I thought there were possibly half a dozen or so, but I think there are only two possibilities now. One is that we are somehow, surreally even, in a 1933 situation where we're all sitting back, those of us who have a brain and that think from time to time, and wondering where this is going, and yet there's this nagging voice in the back of our heads that says, we know where it's going. It's going towards tyranny. And then on the other side, there's the possibility that this is all just entertainment TV, that this man never wanted to be elected president, was surprised by the fact that he was, even though he was only elected by about 1 in 4.6 voters, if you do the math, and by a slavery vestige of the founding of this country, the Electoral College. Even though that's the case, I think there is a possibility that this man really doesn't want to be where he is, and what we're seeing right now is him making the best case of it and his family making the best case of it, for whom my heart goes out, because I don't sense that there's probably that much evil, bad, whatever you want to call it, within the group that surrounds him, his wife, his former wives, his children, and so forth and so on. He's the culprit. He's the one that's dragged them into this. I don't think a single one of them wants to be in this, except possibly people like Jared Kushner, who are Machiavellian in many respects and really, truly interested in only one or two things, which the presidency allows them to expedite power acquisition, therefore. But I don't think the group really wants to be where they are. And I think we're going to see that unfold. If that's the alternative that best describes this man and this presidency, I think we're going to see Pence become the president. I think we're going to see Trump and his entire entourage withdraw increasingly from the whole apparatus.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, when you mentioned Jared Kushner, of course, he's going to be the point man for Middle East peace, and Donald Trump said he will make the deal that nobody else has been able to make. My understanding is from sources in the top levels of the Turkish government, he recently did a tour of the Middle East, met with the top officials in Turkey, and they were briefing him on the region. Of course, it's in flames, and they kept mentioning the PKK, the Kurdish separatist group, and eventually Jared Kushner said, what's the PKK? I mean,
would not surprise me. The ignorance of some of these people who claim to know what our strategic objectives in the world ought to be and how we ought to be pursuing them sometimes stuns me.
Well, just in closing then, what do you think about a pushback? You know, as I mentioned in the opening, the Democrats are adrift and
feckless.
Totally useless. Feckless. And then you've got the Republicans in Congress more interested in power than principle. So where is the pushback going to come apart from what we saw yesterday with women around the world?
I think you've got four Republican parties right now at a minimum, and I think this Reince Priebus business of reaching out and saying, we've won the White House, I'm going to be chief of staff, everything is wonderful now, see, we weren't committed to suicide, we're all in great shape now, look, we've got everything, the House, the Senate, and the White House. I think that's all a farce. I think within six months, probably 3 months, we're going to see that. Ryan's going to fall apart in one direction. Graham and McCain are going to go another direction. The Tea Party leadership is going to go another direction. You've got all kinds of little power centers in the Congress, Senate and House, that are going to fight Trump tooth and nail. This is what brings me to look at that other scenario you were talking about. There's two ways he can deal with that. He can just say, okay, this is just, yeah, this is too tough. I'm going to New York. You got it, Pence. Or he can say, I'm going to defy these people. And his performance in front of the Wall of Heroes at the CIA and other things he's done leads me to believe there's a high propensity for that scenario to unfold, that he is going to become a tyrant, and that the Congress, feckless as it is, and I don't just mean the Democrats, the Republicans are feckless as hell too. McCain can scream, Graham can scream, McConnell can scream, all these people scream. They're cowards when it comes down to it. When it comes down to the root causes of what needs to be done in this country and the challenges we're confronting, they're all a bunch of cowards. I've talked to them on climate change. I've talked to them on ISIS. I've talked to them on most major issues in this country in the last 2 to 3 years. I don't identify a single solitary person over there in that Congress that I'd even want to have tea with over a major issue. They are so purblind, or they are so gutless. So if they're going to challenge this guy, I want to see it. I think what he's going to do is he's going to become a tyrant. If that's the scenario that unfolds, if he really does want power, if he really does relish the prospect of being king, then we're going to see a Congress kowtow to him. And you know what happened when Augustus Julius took over in Rome? The Senate just became a tool of the emperor. There's a possibility for that. That's not exactly 1933 and the evolution of things that happened in Germany, but it's a similar phenomenon. And that, as I said, that side of it worries me, too. I'm almost of the mind that I want the other side, that he leaves town, although I think Pence will be a disaster, too.
Well, Colonel Wilkerson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Wilkerson, a retired United States Army colonel and the former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. And currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into yesterday's historic march for women in the nation's capital across the country and around the world.
So excuse me, Mr. Butter, I'm a Mr. Two, and you're giving Mr. a bad name, Mr. Like You. So I'm taking the Mr. from out in front of your name, 'cause it's Mr. Like You that puts the rest of us to shame. It's a Mr. Like You.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Heidi Hartman, who is the president of the Washington-based Institute for Women's Policy Research, a scientific research organization that she founded in 1987 to meet the need for women-centered, policy-oriented research. Dr. Hartman is also a research professor at the George Washington University, and her areas of expertise are women in the economy, workforce participation, employment pay equity, retirement security, and she lectures widely on women economics and public policy, and frequently testifies before the United States Congress. She's vice chair of the National Council on Women's Organizations and co-editor of the Journal of Women, Politics, and Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Heidi Hartman.
Well, pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you, Heidi Hartman. And what did you make of the extraordinary manifestation of political energy coming from women a day after the inauguration of Donald Trump, not just in the nation's capital, but around the country, and across the country and around the world?
Well, I think it's, to me, it was an amazing phenomenon. Even though I had been personally planning to attend for a very long time and encouraging friends and colleagues who would, you know, call or email me and ask me, you know, what's happening? It seems so disorganized. Should I come? And I was encouraging people to come. It was certainly well beyond my expectations. And obviously, almost every police department in the city and the county, whatever country, has said, wow, there are more people here than we prepared for more people than we thought. So it was an incredible outpouring, and I think it shows how important these issues are to people. And it was, you know, women's issues very, very broadly defined. I mean, I think that was a real strength of this. If we see this as the start of a new form of organizing, grassroots momentum coming out here, it's on a lot of different issues that not everyone thinks of as women's issues, but they truly are. How the economy is doing, how the environment and climate change threatens women and their families. I mean, it's absolutely just about every issue that we saw represented there. Criminal justice was one that I can think of, reproductive rights, of course, health care, of course. So, you know, a fantastic display of organizing, really, grassroots momentum on so many issues and so much criticism of the way, you know, the country looks to be going now under the new president.
Well, the old expression that women hold up half the world is not even adequate, I think, to describe the reality of women both in the workplace and at home, where I believe something over 45% of American households are headed by a woman who's the primary breadwinner. So you have almost half of Americans' children depending on women, not men.
Well, that's quite true. There's a lot of different ways to identify breadwinners, but certainly for primary breadwinner, it includes all those women who are supporting families without the help of a man, plus those women, an increasingly large number, who do, in fact, earn more than their husbands. But most people define it to be more, you know, including dual breadwinners as well, so that, you know, we consider the both breadwinners primary, and then you get an even higher number, because so many families are dependent on the dual earnings of a husband and wife.
But the issues that you work on, pay equity, that indicates how far we've got to go, doesn't it? Would that compare that reality to the paycheck reality?
Absolutely. I mean, it is interesting to me that, you know, at any point in time, a fair number of women, some people say it's even more than 20%, out-earn men. But when you look at out-earn even their particular husband, but when you look at it over time, over a lifetime, there's very few women that over a lifetime, even today, even those who are, you know, going to be retiring, not haven't already retired, but will be retiring in the next 5 or 10 years, there's very few of them that have actually out-earned more than their husbands over their whole lifetime, because they do tend to take more time off to do family care. And even if they earn more per hour, they also tend to work fewer hours. So, you know, these are things that affect your gross income, your annual income. When we compare, when we say it's 80% that men earn as a share of what women earn, that's only comparing those workers who work full-time year-round. Over a lifetime, not that many women do that. So, yes, we're not where we need to be with pay equity. And by the way, one reason why women do tend to work less is that we don't have in this country good structures of subsidized child care, affordable, high-quality child care. We don't have paid family leave in most states. We have paid family leave now in 4 states plus the District of Columbia, and even that is not as generous as what other countries that are as wealthy as we are providing to their workers. So there's lots of reasons why this happens, that it's the women who tend to do more of the family care, because their jobs are also considered, you know, often more expendable to the family, because in most cases the woman is earning less than the man, and if someone's going to give up salary, it should be the woman. So there's lots of economic, you know, lots of ways in which the deck is stacked against the full earnings power of women, and yet we have made a lot of progress in that area, because when I started the labor market, the ratio was 60%, and now it's 80%. So we've closed half the pay gap between women and men in about 40 years. And, of course, we could do better, but it is progress. And I think that one of what has mobilized people to come out yesterday was a sense that all of this progress in so many areas is under threat now. Not just economic progress, but the progress we made in reproductive rights, in providing health care to so many Americans who got new health care under the Affordable Care Act. The environment, we had an environmental pact signed under Obama. What's going to happen to that? So there, you know, net neutrality, that's another issue that could be under threat. All the safety net programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, in addition, supplemental security income, which supports disabled adults and older people who have no other source of income, and children. What's going to happen to all those social safety net programs? I mean, every one of these issues, I think, that impacts women and their families, which includes many men, and of course children, that affects them so directly in their everyday lives. I think people are waking up to that and seeing that this new administration really has the potential of taking away some very hard-fought and hard-earned gains. And I think, as people say, it's you are able to mobilize people more to keep what they fear is going away than to get new things. But we did get these new things over the last, 40, 50, 60 years, and the threat of them being taken away, I think, is what is pushing people out there.
So, Heidi Hartmann, in the last couple of minutes, there is, of course, as I mentioned in the opening, which you didn't hear, that this does feel like an enormous amount of political energy in search of a strategy. But frankly, I would take energy in search of a strategy over strategy in search of energy any day.
Well, I have to agree with you. And, no matter what grassroots popular outpouring we observe, especially in this country, I can't speak for other countries, we always hear the criticism of lack of strategy. Occupy Wall Street was one of them. And what you find happening, and yet I mark those Occupy Wall Street, occupations as something that really began to change the climate, that really made it possible to win, 15-hour wage laws, which we have won now in several areas. So I think that it woke up people to the problem of inequality, the problem of too many of the gains of the economic growth that we were experiencing, moving to the rich and the top 1% even, and not enough of it going to working people. And that's still the case. I mean, we're finally now after, 6 years of recovery, we're finally now beginning to see some real wage gains, but there really weren't many during this whole recovery. And that's a real issue. And since the late 70s, we had not seen American wages on average keeping up with productivity gains. So it was a long-term trend toward inequality, toward moving profits to the rich. And that's, and I think Occupy Wall Street kind of changed the debate and the dynamic on that. And I think we're going to see the same thing with this outpouring. We'll begin to, people will understand that when there is energy for groups that are organized to capture, those groups are going to work to capture that energy. So that's, I think you're absolutely right, that getting the energy is the key problem, and then the strategy and the groups that organize to tap the energy, that follows. And we saw that with Occupy Wall Street. We got many more state and city referenda on equal higher minimum wages, for example. We got labor unions and all kinds of already organized groups coming out for something they thought was at once unattainable, the 15-hour. They all started to come out for it. So, yes, you're absolutely right. When the energy is there, the organizations to tap it and to formulate the strategy follow.
Well, Heidi Hartmann, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, it was my pleasure, and I hope to talk to you again. Thank you.
I do indeed. Bye. And again, I've been speaking with Heidi Hartmann, who's the president of the Washington-based Institute for Women's Policy Research. And joining us now is Glenn Carl, who is the author of The Interrogator and Education. Glenn Carl was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. Welcome to Background Briefing, Glenn Carl.
Thank you for having me.
And Glenn, what did you make of Donald Trump's petulant and infantile display on Saturday in front of the CIA's wall of fallen officers who died in anonymity in service to their country? And of course, I guess that was a bit of a loaded question since I described him as being petulant and infantile. But what was your impression?
Well, I think the media, the journalists of all different kinds of media and the public consistently or almost invariably make the same mistake, which is to try to find some meaning beyond self-aggrandizement and an absolute lack of principle and substance in anything that Donald Trump says or does. he's actually pretty easy to assess. If someone praises him or an entity builds him up in some way or in a way that he perceives as making him more the center of attention and greater in some imagined way, then he will praise you. And if that is not the case, then he will excoriate you or try to destroy you, whether you're a person or an individual. So I think Reince Priebus, probably, although I don't know, somebody who knows how the national security establishments and the government functions, said, you know, you really need to mend fences. It's pretty bad to call an entire class of thousands of people Nazis. So go out there and make nice, and then you can get them on your side. So he tried, but, you know, it's always all about Donald and himself. And that's what it was. It was, you know, an empty self-promoting exercise that was profoundly insulting to the institution and his function and his role.
But clearly there is another agenda, which is that not just repairing fences after having described the intelligence community as likening them to Nazi Germany. Sean Spicer, in his non-press conference where he didn't take questions and where he excoriated the press for suggesting that there were more people at Obama's inauguration than they were Trump's, and trying to, you know, basically rewrite reality, which is certainly not on the Trump administration side here in terms of the numbers, both in comparison to Obama and also in comparison to the women's march yesterday. But nevertheless, they are pushing their reality, whether or not it makes any sense. But he did, in the course of that, say how terrible it is that Donald Trump is over there at the CIA that doesn't have a leader now, and that the Democrats are holding up Mike Pompeo. Now, my understanding is that what's going on here is that there's a frantic effort underway with the Trump administration to stop this counterintelligence investigation into possible collusion between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin. And that's what's going on here, really. The Democrats are delaying Pompeo because the minute Pompeo gets in there, all of this stuff is going to disappear from all of the CIA databases, and there's not going to be any evidence.
Well, this is one of the critical stories that I have not heard almost at all, and that really does deserve prominence. Let me relate what you just said to my own experience and how things function at the CIA. When Porter Goss was named the director of CIA by President Bush, he came over with, and I interacted with him relatively often, given my function at the time. He came over with really one instruction, and that was to, quote, shut down the leaks and clean the place out. Why? Because the Bush administration, the neoconservatives in particular, felt that the intelligence community, especially the CIA, was hostile. And they thought that because we repeatedly said things like, well, you know, Iraq doesn't have anything to do with al-Qaeda. Or if we're worried about proliferation and nuclear weapons, North Korea is a greater immediate problem and substantial one than Iraq and things like this. So we were viewed as the enemy. And he came over, and Porter Goss did, and replaced a lot of people, or meaning eliminated a lot of people, put in a bunch of henchmen who were incompetent but aggressive, and shut down any sort of communications, whether it was through the Publications Review Board by retired people writing or briefings to oversight committees and so on, so that the administration of Bush would not look bad. And that happened. I lived it. We're dealing with an individual who is exponentially more ruthless and amoral. The neoconservatives had a cogent political philosophy. Trump, his philosophy is, how can I make myself be greater? How can I direct attention to me? So yes, what you say is, I am concerned, absolutely the case. Particularly, and this is another important thing, everyone's praising Pompeo because he's an intelligent guy and number one at West Point. So, and these are all impressive qualifications. But the fact is, principle mattered so little to him, or so much to him, however you want to characterize it, that he's one of the leaders in the Benghazi witch hunt. Now, there was never anything to Benghazi. It's a bunch of nonsense. Its sole objective was to destroy Hillary Clinton. There was nothing more to it. And he was quite proud to be one of the leaders in that regard. So that doesn't bode very well from the perspective that you raise or the ones that I fleshed out.
Well, already we know that there was a FISA warrant issued in October, and that it named, from what we can get from leaks, it named Roger Stone, Manafort, and Carter Page. But there's also reports that it also named Donald Trump. Now, my understanding is that furthermore, the intercepts came from Estonian and Lithuanian intelligence about Russian transfers of money to the United States and to troll farms and to fake news. So, what the evidence is so far? Yeah. Because clearly, we'll have a real problem here. Pompeo will probably scrub everything. Already, the White House has scrubbed its own website, gotten rid of all references to global warming, for example, but put up a page where you can buy jewelry crafted by Melania Trump. So it's pretty surreal.
It really is Caligula and Nero, and
right.
We should send them all fiddles. I mean, good God.
But what about the – can they shut down this counterintelligence investigation?
Well, I'm afraid that the answer is substantially yes. It's hard to quash everything in a government as vast as this is, although something of this nature is a very closely held, tightly run, therefore narrowly understood and known issue. But you are on to what I think is the gravest issue facing America in this campaign, beyond the fact that Trump knows nothing and believes he knows everything and is aggressive. I mean, that's the worst conceivable combination. And that is, a year ago, and I'm a retired officer sitting off in Massachusetts, but I know my business. And just watching things with information available to all of us, I started to hop up and down in apprehension and concern that Russian intelligence was meddling in our election and supporting Donald Trump. And I started to reach out to former colleagues and so on. And I learned then, this goes way back beyond earlier than October's FISA, I learned then that, as I was told, now some of this will be not accurate, not completely accurate, but the overall story is correct, I believe, and I think it's been substantiated. I heard then that German intelligence, this is respectively, German intelligence, French intelligence, and British intelligence, I didn't hear at the time about the Baltics, all had received intelligence reports that the Russian intelligence service was meddling in our electoral process and supporting the campaign of Donald Trump, at the very least, if not working with Trump's organization or Trump. And then the CIA and the FBI and the National Security Establishment of the United States got onto this long ago. It was so closely held that it was briefed only to the Gang of Eight, which for listeners means the eight most senior elected officials in the United States government. The chairman and the minority chairman of the Senate and House Oversight Committees, that's four, and the chairman and vice and minority chairman of the House and of the Senate, that is eight. Not even the oversight committees were briefed. Only the Gang of Eight, as well as the chief executive, the president at the time. And then we have heard, all of us, that the Obama administration found itself in the horns of a dilemma. To let this information come out, because it's not proven, and it is a concern, would have been viewed as wildly interfering in the election of our president. So they didn't. And the result was, in fact, the absolute reverse, wild interference in the other direction. But these things have been of grave concern to the national security establishment and remain so. So it's a huge, huge story.
Well, there's so much resistance to it. It's pretty surreal. I can understand the resistance on the right, but for the life of me, I don't understand the resistance on the left to acknowledge the obvious. But do you think, I mean, and by the way, the Baltic stuff, I think, is largely signals intelligence. Will the FBI, they've already, under Comey, they've shown enormous bias in favor of Trump and against Hillary Clinton. But there are people inside that organization that still are, honest. They're the ones that, as far as I know, the lead organization on it, even though they're not particularly good at intelligence. They're a law enforcement agency. They're not an intelligence agency. Right. But what's your confidence then of if the CIA can be basically muzzled, as Dick Cheney did, and he tried to specifically muzzle you, didn't he? So what's this, what do you think of both it, NSA and CIA? Are they going to speak truth to power?
Well, there are countless men and women in the agency, in the bureau, throughout the U.S. government, who are honorable men and women of principle. But let me just give a slightly more narrow, unfortunately, or happily, I guess, narrow example of firsthand tragedy that I lived that addresses your question. I was involved, as you know, and some listeners may recall, in the Enhanced Interrogation Program. Despite the efforts of many, many honorable men and women to live up to the spirit as well as the letter of our oath and our laws in the Department of Justice, in the CIA, in the FBI, in Special Forces, in the JAG Corps, the legal bodies of the U.S. military, despite all of that, it only took literally six people to make torture the practice of our country and to convince large percentages of my colleagues that it was okay and the right thing to do. And it happened in the snap of a finger. And if it happened for torture, so that our checks and balances were overthrown almost instantaneously, it can happen with regard to suppressing a counterintelligence investigation against the now sworn-in 45th president. So I am apprehensive.
So what can we do? I mean, I don't have a lot of faith in the press. After all, the press gave Donald Trump $5 billion worth of free media and helped elect him. He's obviously declaring war on them. Well, he's actually declaring war on reality, frankly.
Yes. Well, I think that gets to the point. I think one of the only things that one can do is, you know, you hear Spicer as the press spokesman, you hear Trump and you hear Kellyanne Conway and on, saying things that are flat lies. Now, you can use euphemisms and say it's a misstatement, it's an alternative fact, I think is the latest formulation that we heard from Conway this morning, and so on. No. We need to speak in simple, direct language, which is a merit that Donald Trump has, really, to use a fourth grader's vocabulary, which means it will be well understood by the general public. And you say, no, that is a lie. 2 and 2 is 4, and the crowd was not that big. That's it. And if you can't speak the truth, you don't have a forum to speak here. I will not allow you to spew garbage. That's, I think, now what do you do when it's the president? I think that's the only thing you can do.
I got very annoyed the other day, Glenn, just in closing, I got very annoyed the other day because I watched that Greta Van Susteren, who came from Fox to MSNBC, talk about before the Women's March to talk to an actress, Patricia Arquette, and say more women voted for Donald Trump than they did for Hillary Clinton. And I knew that was not the case, but she's basically stated fake news as truth. Now, a lot of people obviously, not just me, but other people apparently complained, and now she has had to retract what she said because the statistics simply do not bear out that fake news. So it's possible. I just don't know how you can do it on a It'd be the blizzard of lies that come from Kellyanne Conway, Spicer, and Trump is such that, you know, I don't know, I guess the press is going to form some sort of war room like Clinton had.
Well, you know, I was asked earlier today in a different network what I thought of Trump's visit to the CIA. And I said, look, you have to understand from the beginning and always view him in the following way. That yesterday I was a Nazi, according to him. Today I am an American hero, according to him. His words are absolutely meaningless. They serve one purpose, and that is to self-aggrandizement, to make him the center and the be-all and end-all. Therefore, they're totally discredited in every way. Anything they say should be dismissed as unbelievable until proven true by another party. It's just there's nothing else to do.
Well, Glenn Carl, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Glenn Carl, who is the author of The Interrogator and Education. Glenn Carl was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in 2007 as the Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the disarray or the apparent disarray in terms of a political opposition in this country as Donald Trump assumes power. But they beg you, wait my name.
Responsibility of our nation. a secret agent, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mike Lux, the president of American Family Voices and a partner at Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the president for public liaison to the White House from 1993 to 1995 and is the author of the widely praised book, The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lux.
Thank you, Ian. It's always good to be on.
Well, thank you, Mike. And yesterday's extraordinary display of women, both in Washington, D.C., across the country and around the world, definitely shows that there's an enormous outpouring of political energy out there. Now, you can make the case that this is political energy in search of strategy, but I would make the case that I'd rather have political energy than strategy any day. And so let's assume that strategy is going to follow. Where's it going to come from?
Well, I agree with you. I would so much have political energy and passion, and I think what these women and it was really this was a grassroots outrising. None of the big national organizations were planning to do a big march yesterday. None of them had that, in their ideas or in their plans. They were all too stunned after Trump won against all the predictions. And this came out of the grassroots, and it was so important and so profound, and I think gave a lot of us hope. And I think that's so important. I would also say that being in the streets has to be part of any strategy, because we are not going to win this thing by being smart insiders. It's going to take passion. It's going to take people being in the streets. That's got to be part of the strategy. In terms of where you asked, sort of where strategy will come from, I think it will come both from the grassroots, from the net roots, from outsiders, and of course it will need to come. There need to be some strategy on the inside as well. And I think, frankly, the Democratic Party is very divided right now as to what that strategy should be. So I think we have a fascinating period ahead, as all that gets sorted out. And I think it will take a while to get sorted out.
But so far, the indications are that the Bernie Sanders revolution is simply not being acknowledged, and that the populist messages coming from the millennial generation, labor organizers and grassroots activists, are simply not even acknowledged, which is extraordinary, given how Bernie Sanders did come out of nowhere and did exceptionally well, but more importantly, galvanized a whole generation. And if you were running any kind of political organization, you would think, oh, well, these kids are our future. We got to harness this energy.
Absolutely.
And
I don't know that I agree with you, Ian, that it's not being acknowledged. It all depends on who you're talking to. But I think there are actually a lot of people acknowledging it. I think that the fact that Keith Ellison is one of the two front runners who your listeners probably know was one of the lead endorsers of Bernie Sanders and as part of that movement is the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, one of the most progressive people in Congress. The fact that he's one of the two leading candidates for the DNC chair position and got out of the gates very strong and got some endorsements from people that no one expected, like Chuck Schumer, I think that's a sign that people are saying, "Wow, we ought to take these Bernie folks more seriously." Now, obviously, there's there's a big pushback against that, and you know, not everyone is comfortable with the idea of Bernie's people, you know, taking over per se. But I do think there are some in the party, at least, who are listening, and that goes back to that divide that I was talking about. I think that part of the Democratic Party gets the importance of the grassroots, the Sanders Revolution, the net roots, and part of the party thinks that we can just keep doing things the same old way. I happen to be on the on the side of the former, of the, you know, that we need that grassroots energy, and that we need you know, the outsider you know, progressive movement energy, and that if we don't have that, there will be no way to beat Trump and the Republicans.
Well, there have been manifestations of denial and blindness, both at the DNC meeting that took place last Wednesday at George Washington University, where there were all the candidates, 37 candidates to head up the DNC, were on display. Very little talk of grassroots populism. And, of course, there was a meeting down in Miami for the last couple of days, organized by David Brock, a Hillary Clinton operative, and he basically is in denial, basically saying that the whole defeat of Hillary Clinton was a black swan incident, and it only happened because of James Comey and Vladimir Putin. That's not particularly encouraging, and that, of course, was funded by George Soros. So, you know, after all the money that Hillary Clinton blew through, it just seems like good money's being thrown after bad. So what is this tradition that really seems to haunt the Democrats and doesn't seem to affect the Republicans? They seem to have better talent. Kellyanne Conway, by the way, is extraordinary, the way she can put lipstick on this pig. And then you've got, you know, there's these losers like Susan Estrich, who's now ran the Dukakis campaign, and now Roger Ailes' lawyer, Donna Brazile, now at the DNC. She's another loser, Robbie Mook. There's a whole pantheon of people who lose elections and yet remain Democratic establishment figures. Can't we find a winner?
Well, you know, let me walk you back just a little bit. I mean, we have won. Democrats have won the popular vote in every election except for 2004, since 1992. We have won the Electoral College, you know, four times in that period, lost at three. So it's not like the Democrats, quote unquote, have never won an election. I would argue that Al Gore absolutely won that election, but it was stolen away. So I wouldn't list Donna Brazile among your quote-unquote losers. I think they won that election. They didn't win it by big enough that it couldn't be stolen away, which is also true of this one, unfortunately, with voter suppression and all the things they've done to steal votes. So I wouldn't paint as bleak a picture as you would, but I would also say to the black swan people that they're absolutely wrong as well. I mean, when we have lost, you know, an extraordinary number of state legislative seats, congressional seats, Senate seats, governor seats over the last several elections, basically since 2009, except for, you know, the one shining example of Barack Obama winning re-election in 2012 and he won, by the way, being a strong progressive populist in his campaign, going after Romney's Bain Capital history and going after the 47% comment, and I mean he really ran a great race. People like Elizabeth Warren, Elizabeth was the one person who beat an incumbent senator that year. Sherrod Brown won re-election in spite of huge amounts of money spent against him. So 2012 was the exception. But beyond that, we've lost a ton of races, and we've lost at every level. And now we've lost the presidency, in part because of Comey and the Russians. I mean, I think we have to give that some credit, but in great part because we had a bad strategy. We didn't have a strong economic message. We didn't target the right voters. We didn't have a message that would, bring the party together and consolidate the Sanders vote for Hillary. So I believe that we blew it in this election, and that you can say that, Comey had an impact. Of course he did. Of course he did. You can say that the Russians had an impact. Absolutely. But we still should have won this election. We still should have won the Senate. If we had done a better job of turning out and motivating and consolidating our base, we would have done those two things, and that's on the Democrats. So this is not, I don't see this as a black swan.
Well, let's hope that, as I say, I prefer strategy. I prefer energy over strategy. But at this point, we've seen the energy, and now we're waiting for the strategy.
Well, we need some of both. Clearly,
yeah,
no question.
So since I'm the pessimist here, give me a quick piece of hope.
Well, look, in 2004, we had a very discouraging election. The Republicans controlled every branch of government, and over the next 4 years, we fought back on big economic issues like Social Security privatization. We fought back on the Iraq War craziness. We united the progressive movement, and there was all kinds of energy at the grassroots and the netroots level, and we came back strong. And against all predictions, We won both houses of Congress in 2006, and we won the presidency strongly and added to those margins in 2008. I think we can do the same thing this time, and I think the grassroots energy of those marches yesterday proves that. We just have to motivate our people. We have to fight hard on economic issues. We have to fight hard mm-hmm. on the issues that motivate the progressive and Democratic base. And I think we can come back strong. And I think that is essential for our democracy, because if we don't, we are in a world of hurt for a long time to come, and maybe
right.
maybe a world where American democracy as we've known it ends.
Well, Mark Lux, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Lux, the president of American Family Voices and a partner in Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.